Corregidor. There is no fixed boundary between the water of Manila Bay and the humid air above it, only a featureless blue-gray shroud hanging a couple of miles away. Glory 4 maneuvers cautiously through an immense strewing of anchored cargo ships for about half an hour, then picks up speed and heads out into the center of the bay. The air thins a bit, allowing Randy a good view of Bataan off to starboard. Black mountains, mostly veiled in haze and speckled by the mushroom-capped shaped clouds of ascending thermals. For the most part, it has no beaches, just red cliffs plummeting the last few yards into the sea. But as they work their way out to the end of the peninsula, the land tails off more gently and supports a few pale green fields. At the very tip of Bataan are a couple of stabbing limestone crags that Randy recognizes from Avi's video, but by this point he has eyes mostly for Corregidor itself, which lies a few miles off the end of the peninsula. America Shafto, or Amy as she likes to be called, spends most of the voyage bustling around on the deck, engaging the Filipino and American divers in bursts of serious conversation, sometimes sitting cross-legged on the deck plates to go over papers or charts. She has donned a frayed straw cowboy hat to protect her head from solar radiation. Randy's in no hurry to expose himself. He ambles around the air-conditioned cabin, sipping his coffee and looking at the photographs on the walls. He is naively expecting to see pictures of divers landing submarine cables on beaches. Semper Marine Services does a fair amount of cable work and does it well. He checked their references before hiring them, but they apparently did not consider that kind of work interesting enough to photograph. Most of these pictures are of undersea salvage operations. Divers with enormous grins on their leathery faces, triumphantly holding up barnacle-encrusted vases, like hockey players brandishing the Stanley Cup. From a distance, Corregidor is a lens of jungle bulging out of the water with a flat shelf extending off to one side. From the maps, he knows that it is really a sperm-shaped affair. What looks like a shell from this angle is its tail, which snakes off to the east as if the sperm were trying to swim out of Manila Bay to impregnate Asia. Amy storms past and throws the cabin door open. "Come to the bridge," she says. "You should see this." Randy follows her. "Who's the guy in most of those pictures?" he asks. "Scary? Crew cut?" "Yeah. That's my father," she says. "Doug." "Would that be Douglas MacArthur Shafto?" Randy asks. He's seen the name on some of the documents that he's exchanged with Semper Marine. "The same. The ex-SEAL?" "Yeah, but he doesn't like to be referred to that way. It is such a cliché." "Why does he seem familiar to me?" Amy sighs. "He had his 15 minutes of fame back in 1975. I'm having trouble remembering. You know Comstock?"
"Attorney General Paul Comstock? Hates crypto?"
"I'm talking about his father, Earl Comstock."
"Cold War policy guy. The brains behind the Vietnam War, right?"
"I've never heard him described that way, but yeah, we're talking about the same guy. You might remember that back in 1975, Earl Comstock fell or was pushed off a ski lift in Colorado and broke his arms?"
"Oh yeah, it's sort of coming back to me."
"My pop," Amy does a little head fake towards one of the photographs, "happened to be seated right next to him at the time."
"By accident or total chance, not planned?"
"Well, that's one way to look at it," Randy says.
"But on the other hand, if Earl Comstock went skiing frequently, the probability was actually rather high that sooner or later he'd find himself sitting 50 feet off the ground next to a Vietnam combat veteran."
"Whatever. All I'm saying is, I don't want to talk about it, actually."
"Am I going to get to meet this character?" Randy asks, looking at the photograph.
Amy bites her lip and squints at the horizon. 90% of the time his presence is a sign that something really weird is going on." She opens the hatch to the bridge and holds it for him, pointing out the high step.
"The other 10%?
"He's bored. We're on the outs with his girlfriend."
Glory's pilot is concentrating intensely and ignores them, which Randy takes to be a sign of professionalism. The bridge has many counters fashioned from doors or thick plywood, and all of the available space is covered with electronic gear. A fax, a smaller machine that spews out weather bulletins, 3 computers, a satellite phone, a few GSM phones socketed into their chargers, depth-sounding gear. Amy leads him over to a machine with a big screen that is showing what looks like a black-and-white photo of rugged terrain. Side-scan sonar, she explains. One of our best tools for this kind of work. Shows us what's on the bottom. She checks one of the computer screens for their current coordinates and then runs a quick calculation in her head. Ernesto, change course 5 degrees to starboard, please.
Yes, ma'am,
Ernesto says, and makes it happen.
What are you looking for?
This is a freebie, like the cigarettes at the hotel, Amy explains. Just an extra added bonus for doing business with us. Sometimes we like to play tour guide. See? Check that out.
She uses her pinky to point out something that is just becoming visible on the screen.
Randy hunches over and peers at it. It is clearly a man-made shape, a jumble of straight lines and right angles.
Looks like a heap of debris, he says.
It is now, Amy says, but it used to be a good chunk of the Filipino treasury.
What?
During the war, Amy says, after Pearl Harbor, but before the Japanese took Manila, the government emptied out the treasury. They put all the gold and silver into crates and shipped it to Corregidor for safekeeping, supposedly.
What do you mean, supposedly?
She shrugs. This is the Philippines, she says. I have the feeling a lot of it ended up elsewhere, but a lot of the silver ended up there. She straightens up and nods out the window at Corregidor. At the time, they thought Corregidor was impregnable. When was this, roughly?
December 41 or January 42?
Anyway, it became obvious that Corregidor was going to fall. A submarine came and took away the gold at the beginning of February. Then another sub came and took off guys they couldn't allow to be captured, like codebreakers. But they didn't have enough subs to carry away all the silver. MacArthur left in March. They started taking the silver out in crates in the middle of the night and dropping it into the water.
You're shitting me.
They could always come back later and try to recover it, Amy says. Better to lose it all than let the Japanese take it, right?
I guess so.
The Japanese recovered a lot of that silver. They captured a bunch of American divers on Bataan and Corregidor and made them go down, right down below where we are at this moment, and recover it. But those same divers managed to hide a lot of silver from their guards and get it to Filipinos who smuggled it into Manila, where it became so common that it totally debased the Japanese occupation currency.
So what are we seeing right now?
The remains of old crates that burst open when they hit the seafloor, Amy says.
Was there any of that silver left when the war ended?
Oh, sure, Amy says breezily. Most of it was dumped here. And those divers got it, but some was dumped in other areas. My dad recovered some of it as late as the 1970s.
Wow. That doesn't make any sense.
Why not?
I can't believe that piles of silver just sat on the bottom of the ocean for 30 years, free for the taking.
You don't know the Philippines very well, Amy says.
I know that it's a poor country.
Why didn't someone come out and get that silver? Most of the treasure hunters in this part of the world are looking for much bigger game, Amy says. Or easier.
Randy's nonplussed. A pile of silver on the bottom of the bay seems big and easy to me.
It's not. Silver's not worth that much. A Sung Dynasty vase, cleaned up, can go for more than its weight in gold.
Gold.
And it's easier to find the vase. You just scan the seafloor looking for something shaped like a junk. A sunken junk makes a distinctive image on sonar, whereas an old crate, all busted up and covered with coral and barnacles, tends to look like a rock.
As they draw closer to Corregidor, Randy can see that the tail of the island is lumpy, with big stacks of rock protruding from it here and there. The color of the land fades gradually from dark jungle green to pale green, and then a sear reddish-brown as the tail extends from the fat center of the island out to the end, and the soil becomes drier. Randy's gaze is fixed on one of those rocky crags, which is surmounted by a new steel tower. Atop the tower is a microwave horn aimed east, toward Epiphyte's building in Intramuros.
See those caves along the waterline? Amy says. She seems to regret having mentioned sunken treasure in the first place and now wants to get off the subject. Randy tears himself away from admiring the microwave antenna, of which he is part owner, and looks in the direction Amy's pointing. The limestone flank of the island, which drops vertically the last few meters into the water, is riddled with holes.
Yeah?
Built by Americans to house beach defense guns. Enlarged by the Japanese as launch sites for suicide boats.
Wow.
Randy notices a deep gargling noise and looks over to see that a boat has fallen in alongside them. It is a canoe-shaped affair, maybe 40 feet long, with long outriggers on either side. A couple of ragged flags fly from a short mast, and bright laundry flaps gaily from various lines strung here and there. A big, naked diesel engine sits in the middle of the hull, flailing the atmosphere with black smoke. Forward of that, several Filipinos, including women and children, are gathered in the shade of a bright blue tarpaulin, eating. Aft, a couple of men are fiddling with diving equipment. One of them is holding something up to his mouth, a microphone. A voice blares from Glory's radio, speaking Tagalog. Ernesto stifles a laugh, picks up the mic, and answers briefly. Randy doesn't know what they are saying, but he suspects it is something like, "Let's horse around later. Our client is on the bridge right now."
"Business associates," Amy explains dryly.
Her body language says that she wants to get away from Randy and back to work.
"Well, thanks for the tour," Randy says. "One question."
Amy raises her eyebrows, trying to look patient. "How much of Semper Marine's revenue derives from treasure hunting?"
"This month, this year, the last 10 years, over the lifetime of the company?" Amy asks.
"Whatever."
"That kind of income is sporadic," Amy says.
"Glory was paid for, and then some by pottery that we recovered from a junk. But some years we get all of our revenue from jobs like this one."
"In other words, boring jobs that suck," Randy says.
He just blurts it out. Normally, he controls his tongue a little better, but shaving off his beard has blurred his ego boundaries or something. He's expecting her to laugh or at least wink at him, but she takes it very seriously. She has a pretty good poker face.
"Think of it as making license plates," she says.
"So you guys are basically a bunch of treasure hunters," Randy says. "You just make license plates to stabilize your cash flow."
"Call us treasure hunters if you like," Amy says. "Why are you in business, Randy?"
She turns around and stalks out of the place. Randy's still watching her go when he hears Ernesto cursing under his breath, not so much angry as astonished. Glory is swinging around the tip of Corregidor's tail now, and the entire southern side of the island is becoming visible for the first time. The last mile or so of the tail curves around to form a semicircular bay. Anchored in the center of this bay is a white ship that Randy identifies at first as a small ocean liner with rakish and wicked lines. Then he sees the name painted on its stern, Ruy Falero, Santa Monica, California. Randy goes and stands next to Ernesto, and they stare at the white ship for a while. Randy has heard about it. And Ernesto, like everyone else in the Philippines, knows about it. But seeing it is another thing entirely. A helicopter sits on its afterdeck like a toy. A dagger-shaped muscle boat hangs from a davit, ready for use as a dinghy. A brown-skinned man in a gleaming white uniform can be seen polishing a brass rail.
"Ruy Falero was Magellan's cosmographer," Randy says.
"Cosmographer?"
"The brains of the operation," Randy says, tapping his head.
"He came here with Magellan?" Ernesto asks. In most of the world, Magellan is thought of as the first guy who went around the world. Here, everyone knows he only made it as far as Mactan Island, where he was killed by Filipinos.
"When Magellan set out on his ship, Falero stayed behind in Seville," Randy says. "He went crazy."
"You know a lot about Magallanes, eh?" Ernesto says.
"No," Randy says.
I know a lot about the dentist.
Don't talk to the dentist, ever. Not about anything. Not even tech stuff. Any technical questions he asks you is just a stalking horse for some business tactic that is as far beyond your comprehension as Gödel's proof would be to Daffy Duck.
Abby told Randy this spontaneously one evening as they were tucking into dinner at a restaurant in downtown Makati. Abby refuses to discuss anything important within a mile of the Manila Hotel because he thinks every room and every table is under surveillance.
Well, thanks for the vote of confidence, Randy said.
Hey, Abby said, I'm just trying to stake out my turf here, justify my existence in this project. I'll handle the business stuff.
You're not being a little paranoid?
Listen, the dentist has at least $1 billion of his own and another $10 billion under management. Half the fucking orthodontists in Southern California retired at age 40 because he decupled their IRAs in the space of 2 or 3 years. You don't achieve those kinds of results by being a nice guy.
Maybe he just got lucky.
He did get lucky. But that doesn't mean he's a nice guy. My point is that he put that money into investments that were extremely risky. He played Russian roulette with his investors' life savings, keeping them in the dark. I mean, this guy would invest in a Mindanao kidnapping ring if it gave a good rate of return.
Does he understand that he was lucky, I wonder?
That's my question. I'm guessing no. I think he considers himself to be an instrument of divine providence like Douglas MacArthur.
Rui Falero is the pride of Seattle's superyacht industry, which has been burgeoning ever so discreetly of late. Randy gleaned a few facts about it from a marketing brochure that was published before the dentist actually bought the ship, so he knows that the helicopter and the speedboat came included in the purchase price, which has never been divulged. The vessel contains, among other things, 10 tons of marble. The master bedroom suite contains full his and hers bathrooms, lined with black marble and pink marble, respectively, so that the dentist and the diva don't have to fight over sink space when they are primping for a big event in the grand ballroom.
The dentist? Ernesto says.
Kepler. Dr. Kepler, Randy says. In the States, some people call him the dentist. People in the high-tech industry. Ernesto nods knowingly.
A man like that could have had any woman in the world, he says. But he picked a Filipina.
Yes, says Randy cautiously.
In the States, do people know the story of Victoria Vigo?
I must tell you that she is not as famous in the States as she is here.
Of course.
But some of her songs were very popular. Many people know that she came from great poverty.
Do people in the States know about Smoky Mountain? The garbage dump in Tondo, where children hunt for food?
Some of them do.
It will be very famous when the movie about Victoria Vigo's life shows on television. Ernesto nods, seemingly satisfied. Everyone here knows that a movie about the diva's life is being made, starring herself. They generally don't know that it's a vanity project, financed by the dentist, and that it will be aired only on cable television in the middle of the night. But they probably know that it will leave out all the good parts.
As far as the dentist is concerned, Abby said, our advantage is that when it comes to the Philippines, he will be predictable. Tame. Even docile.
He smiles cryptically.
How so?
Victoria Vigo whored her way up out of Smoky Mountain, right?
Well, there seems to be a lot of nudging and winking to that effect, but I've never heard anyone come out and say it before.
Randy said, glancing around nervously.
Believe me, it's the only way she could have gotten out of there. Pimping arrangements were handled by the Bolobolos. This is a group from northern Luzon that was brought into power along with Marcos. They run that part of town. Police, organized crime, local politics, you name it. Consequently, they own her. They have photographs, videos from the days when she was an underage prostitute and porn film starlet.
Randy shook his head in disgust and amazement.
How the hell do you get this information?
Never mind. Believe me, in some circles, it's as well known as the value of pi.
Not my circles. Anyway, the point is that her interests are aligned with the Bolobolos and always will be. And the dentist is always going to obediently do whatever his wife tells him to.
Can you really assume that? Randy said.
He's a tough guy.
He probably has a lot more money and power than the Bulobulos. He can do whatever he wants.
But he won't,
Avi says, smiling that little smile again.
He'll do what his wife tells him to.
How do you know that?
Look, Avi said, Kepler is a major control freak, just like most powerful rich men, right?
Right.
If you are that much of a control freak, what sexual preferences does that translate into?
I hope I'll never know. I suppose you would want to dominate a woman.
Wrong, Avi said. Sex is more complicated than that, Randy. Sex is a place where people's repressed desires come out. People get most turned on when their innermost secrets are revealed.
Shit. Kepler's a masochist?
He is such a fucking masochist that he was famous for it. At least in the Southeast Asian sex industry. Pimps and madams in Hong Kong, Bangkok, Shenzhen, Manila, they all had files on him. They knew exactly what he wanted. And that's how he met Victoria Vigo. He was in Manila City, working on the Philatel deal. Spent a lot of time here, staying in a hotel that's owned and bugged by the Bulobulos. They studied his mating habits like entomologists watching the reproductive habits of ants. They groomed Victoria Vigo, their ace, their bombshell, their sexual terminator, to give Kepler exactly what Kepler wanted. Then they sent her into his life like a guided fucking missile and pow, true love.
You think he would have been suspicious or something? I'm surprised he'd get that involved with a whore.
He didn't know she was a whore. That's the beauty of the plan. The Bulobulos set her up with a fake identity as a concierge at Kepler's hotel. A demure Catholic schoolgirl.
It starts with her getting him tickets to a play. And inside of a year, he's chained to his bed on that fucking mega yacht of his with strap marks on his ass, and she's standing over him with a wedding ring on her finger the size of a headlamp. The 138th richest woman in the world.
125th, Randy corrected him. Philatel stock has been on a bull run lately.
Randy spends the next days trying not to run into the dentist. He stays at a small private inn up on the top of the island, eating continental breakfast every morning with an assortment of American and Nipponese war veterans who have come here with their wives to, Randy supposes, deal with emotional issues a million times more profound than anything Randy's ever had to contend with. The Rui Falero is nothing if not conspicuous, and Randy can get a pretty good idea of whether the dentist is aborted by watching the movements of the helicopter and the speedboat. When he thinks it's safe, he goes down to the beach below the microwave antenna and watches Amy's divers work on the cable installation. Some of them are working out in the surf zone, bolting sections of cast iron pipe around the cable. Some are working a couple of miles offshore, coordinating with a barge that is injecting the cable directly into the muddy seafloor with a giant, cleaver-like appendage. The shore end of the cable runs into a new reinforced concrete building, set back about 100 meters from the high tide level. It is basically just a big room filled with batteries, generators, air conditioning units, and racks of electronic equipment. The software running on that equipment is Randy's responsibility. And so he spends most of his time in that building, staring into a computer screen and typing. From there, transmission lines run up the hill to the microwave tower. The other end is being extended out towards a buoy that is bobbing in the South China Sea a few kilometers away. Attached to that buoy is the end of the North Luzon Coastal Festoon, a cable owned by Philatel that runs up the coast of the island. If you follow it far enough, you reach a building at the northern tip of the island where a big cable from Taiwan comes in. Taiwan, in turn, is heavily webbed into the world submarine cable network. It is easy and cheap to get data into or out of Taiwan. There is only one gap left in the private chain of transmission that Epiphyte and Philatel are trying to establish from Taiwan to downtown Manila, and that gap gets narrower by the day, as the cable barge grinds its way towards the buoy. When it finally gets there, Rui Falero weighs anchor and glides out to meet it. The helicopter and the speedboat and a flotilla of hired boats go into action, ferrying dignitaries and media crews out of Manila. Avi shows up carrying two fresh tuxedos from a tailor shop in Shanghai.
All those famous Hong Kong tailors were refugees from Shanghai.
He and Randy tear off the tissue paper, put them on, and then ride in an unair-conditioned jeepney down the hill to the dock, where Gloria awaits them. 2 hours later, Randy gets to lay eyes on the dentist and the diva for the first time ever, in the grand ballroom of the Rui Folero. To Randy, the party is like any other. He shakes hands with a few people, forgets their names, finds a place to sit down, and enjoys the wine and the food in blissful solitude. The one thing that is special about this party is that two tar-covered cables, each about the thickness of a baseball bat, are running up onto the quarterdeck. If you go to the rail and look down, you can see them disappear into the brine. The cable ends meet on a tabletop in the middle of the deck, where a technician, flown in from Hong Kong and dutied up in a tuxedo, sits with a box of tools working on the splice. He is also working on a big hangover, but that is fine with Randy, since he knows that it's all fake. The cables are just scraps, their loose ends trailing in the water alongside the yacht. The real splice was performed yesterday and is already lying on the bottom of the sea with bits running through it. There is another man on the quarterdeck, mostly staring at Batan and Corregidor, but also keeping an eye on Randy. The moment Randy notices him, this man nods, as if checking something off a list in his head, stands up, walks over, and joins him. He is wearing a very ornate uniform, the U.S. Navy equivalent of black tie. He is mostly bald, and what hair he does have is battleship gray, and shorn to a length of perhaps 5 millimeters. As he walks toward Randy, several Filipinos watch him with obvious curiosity. "Randy," he says. Metals clink together as he grips Randy's right hand and shakes it. He looks to be around 50, but he has the skin of an 80-year-old Bedouin. He has a lot of ribbons on his chest, and many of them are red and yellow, which are colors that Randy vaguely associates with Vietnam. Above his pocket is a little plastic nameplate reading Shafto.
"Don't be deceived, Randy," says Douglas MacArthur Shafto. "I'm not on active duty. Retired eons ago. But I'm still entitled to wear this uniform, and it's a hell of a lot easier than going out and trying to find a tuxedo that fits me."
"Pleased to meet you."
"Pleasure's mine. Where'd you get yours, by the way?"
"My tuxedo?"
"Yeah."
My partner had it made."
"Your business partner or your sexual partner?"
"Oh, my business partner. At the moment, I am without a sexual partner." Doug Shafto nods impassively.
"It is telling that you have not obtained one in Manila, as our host did, for example."
Randy looks into the ballroom at Victoria Vigo, who, if she were any more radiant, would cause paint to peel from the walls and window panes to sag like caramel.
"I guess I'm just shy or something," Randy says.
"Are you too shy to listen to a business proposition?"
"Not at all."
"My daughter asserts that you and our host might lay some more cables around here in coming years."
"Well, in business, people rarely plan to do a thing only once," Randy says. "It messes up the spreadsheets."
"You are aware by now that the water in this area is shallow."
"Yeah."
"You know that cables cannot be laid in shallow water without extremely detailed high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys."
"Yes."
"I would like to perform those surveys for you, Randy."
"I see."
"No, I don't think you do see. But I want you to see, and so I'm going to explain it."
"Okay," Randy says. "Should I bring my partner out?"
"The concept I am about to convey to you is very simple and does not require two first-rate minds in order to process it,"
Doug Shafto says.
"Okay. What is the concept?"
"The detailed survey will be just chock-full of new information about what is on the floor of the ocean in this part of the world. Some of that information might be valuable. More valuable than you imagine."
"Ah," Randy says. "You mean that it might be the kind of thing that your company knows how to capitalize on?"
"That's right,"
says Doug Shafto.
"Now, if you hire one of my competitors to perform your survey and they stumble on this kind of information, they will not tell you about it. They will exploit it themselves. You will not know that they have found anything, and you will not profit from it. But if you hire Semper Marine Services,
I will tell you about whatever I find, and I will cut you and your company in on a share of any proceeds.
Randy says. He is trying to figure out how to do a poker face, but he knows that Shafto sees right through him.
On one condition,
Doug Shafto says.
I suspected there might be a condition.
Every hook that's worth a damn has a barb. This is the barb.
What is it? Randy asks.
We keep it a secret from that son of a bitch,
Doug Shafto says, jerking his thumb at Hubert Kepler.
Because if the dentist finds out, then he and the Bolobolos will just split the entire thing up between them and we'll see nothing. There's even a chance we would end up dead.
Well, the being dead part is something that we will certainly have to think about, Randy says. But I will convey your proposal to my partner.